May it please the court. My name is Doyle Baker. I'm a deputy district attorney from the 4th Judicial District. I represent the people in this appeal. The joinder statute, the rule governing joinder, and the case law that interpret those authorities don't just protect the rights of the accused. They also protect the people by providing them with direction on how they can effectively prosecute multiple cases. The Jeffrey decision states that the people satisfy the purposes of the joinder requirement if, at the time jeopardy attaches in the initial prosecution, the people know of the other offenses and they've moved to join separately filed cases into a single prosecution.
Pardon me for interrupting you right up front, Mr. Baker. I'm sorry about
that. That's quite all right, Your Honor.
But would you please address argument that that language out of Jeffrey is dicta and is not controlling precedent?
Yes, Your Honor. Essentially, Jeffrey does two things. Jeffrey tells us what happens if no motion for joinder is filed. And it also tells us what an effective motion for joinder looks like. In other words, a motion that will allow the prosecution to try multiple cases. Now, if the language that the district court rejected as dicta is considered as dicta, the Jeffrey opinion in its entirety is meaningless because the prosecution has no ability to protect themselves from what occurred in a situation like this. A defendant is able to oppose joinder and then turn around and later move to dismiss a case on the ground that the very thing that he opposed, joinder, should have occurred.
Well, Mr. Baker, when the court refuses to permit a compulsory joinder, isn't the court saying proceed on the complaint you've got or dismiss it?
The court, I think, was saying at the point we moved for joinder and the court rejected it, our case was not dismissed. And at that point, as far as we were concerned, we had two cases. And based on the language in Jeffrey, which was what we were using to guide ourselves, we felt that we had satisfied the requirements of joinder, and the fact that the court said, I'm not going to join these, did not mean that we had to choose between which case that we were going to prosecute, but that in fact we could try them both sequentially.
But the court went on to say, hey, you're going to use evidence in the second case as res gestae. I'm not going to let you do that.
Well,
wasn't that an indication to you that the judge said, hey, proceed with your case or go away?
I think what that indicated to us was that we had perhaps an evidentiary issue, but that did not indicate to us that we could not try the second case. Perhaps we could not introduce evidence from the first case, but we did what Jeffrey required of us to protect our second case. And we had no indication that we couldn't engage in sequential prosecutions until we got to the hearing on the motion to dismiss. We cited Jeffrey and the judge, rather than dealing directly with the language in Jeffrey, excused it as dicta.
Pardon me, Mr. Baker, but didn't you get several warnings that this was going down this way? At one point, defense counsel came in and filed a notice, you know, predicting exactly this. And then at the hearing, at the motion to join, didn't the trial court tell you that you were playing with fire? And I believe that's the phrase that the trial court used.
That is the phrase the trial court used, Your Honor. Again, you know, we at that point had no motion to dismiss. The judge had not indicated that he was going to for certain dismiss this case. Thereafter, we took steps to consolidate the cases. That was rejected. you know, we've got the trial court on the one hand telling us these things, and on the other hand, we have the Jeffrey decision out there telling us this is how, as a prosecutor, you protect your case. Before jeopardy attaches in either case, you file your motion for joinder.
Well, wasn't the trial court here concerned principally with what he considered to be a lack of fundamental fairness in the way this was happening?
He talks about due process at the motion to dismiss, and he, when you look at that statement from the judge, which is at the very end of the hearing that was held on June 27th, it's hard to tell what he's saying exactly. He does say, I wish you would have told me back in, I guess, 2011, that you were, number one, thinking of filing charges, and that, number two, at that point, perhaps you should have let me know that you were going to consolidate these cases. Certainly he was concerned with fairness, but what he was doing also was changing the law that's stated in Jeffrey, which says that you have, as a prosecutor, up until the point jeopardy attaches, to file this motion. And frankly, in 2011, we had not made a charging decision. And when we had the hearing on the motion to continue in September, we stated we hoped to make a charging decision by the end of the year. Now, a statement that we hope to make a charging decision is not a statement that we're going to file charges. A charging decision could be a decision not to charge. We hadn't made our mind up, frankly, at the time that the judge was saying you should have told us that you were going to file these charges and you should have told us that you were thinking of consolidating them.
Mr. Baker, even if we accept your reading of Jeffrey, wouldn't we have to remand for findings on whether or not the people's actions violated the defendant's right to due process?
I'm not sure that you do, Judge, because although they raised that issue, the judge didn't find that persuasive in that he didn't say that was the reason.
No, but he didn't have to, because he ruled on the basis of his understanding of Jeffrey. But
right.
He clearly, at least the way I read it, he was indicating there might be another basis for this ruling, namely due process, and he didn't need to reach that because of his disposition under Jeffrey. And my question is, if that's the case, wouldn't we have to, at a minimum, remand for findings on due process?
I don't think that's necessarily the case, Your Honor. I think the defendant could renew his objection on that ground. But I think that at this point what we're dealing with is the judge's decision and the grounds on which he did decide this. There were also arguments made as to things like collateral estoppel that were not considered by the judge to be binding. He didn't find those persuasive. And he simply refused to rule on any other basis. So I think on the basis that he has ruled, if you find that that's incorrect, you can simply remand it for further proceedings.
Mr. Baker, let me get to the elephant in my room, and that is, given the posture of the defendant in this case, who hears what the judge says about Jeffrey, who doesn't think there's a difference between good dicta and bad dicta, dicta's dicta, and who opposes the joinder on any basis, whether it's compulsory or not, how is it inconsistent for the defendant to object to the joinder and then at a later time say, well, you got to dismiss this because it should have been compulsorily joined? I'm not sure that I see the inconsistency that you see there.
Well, the Supreme Court certainly thought it was inconsistent and applied a waiver analysis in just that situation in Jeffrey and said that a defendant who's opposing joinder, they're going forward is going to waive any objection to joinder. You know, we, in our motion to join, put the defendant on notice that one of the reasons that we were doing this was to protect his double jeopardy rights. In the final paragraph of our motion, we say that. At the hearing on the motion, our attorney argued that we were trying to protect the defendant's double jeopardy rights in addition to all the other reasons that we were seeking joinder. So the defendant, his reason for opposing joinder was, I haven't had enough time to prepare for this case. In other words, he wanted the same consideration that we were seeking. We had 11 months to unravel what in reality was a big fat mess and involved the examination of 9,000 financial documents.
Well, he didn't want a continuance because he has speedy trial rights.
And he certainly is entitled to give that up. But, Your Honor, while a defendant has rights, he also has choices. And in this case, the defendant said, I want more time. I don't have enough time to prepare for these new charges. That's his right. But we also have the right to try this case. And Jeffrey talks in terms of liberal consolidation of charges. It doesn't talk in terms of liberal dismissal, which is, in fact, I think what happened here. We take this case as it comes to us. And this case had a very complex fact pattern that we had to unravel. It took us 11 months, but we did a methodical, thorough investigation, and we thought, based on Jeffrey, that we had that right and that we could consolidate these cases up to the point that jeopardy attached.
Let me ask you a hypothetical. If you had made a decision to file charges in the second case, but then you also deliberately waited until the day of trial on the first case, and on the morning of the first case, you file the new charges and you file a motion to consolidate, would your argument be the same here today?
Well, I think, Your Honor, and then you go back to the due process concerns. And one of the cases that the defense cited in their motion to dismiss was a case called Abramson, which in that case, the Supreme Court talked about, even though the prosecution could, in theory, be complying with what the law requires of them, if you look in reality as a practical matter at what they're doing, they are violating the defendant's rights. And I think that if we had deliberately delayed, we'd have a different situation. But here, we were requesting documents up until December 13th. The last court-ordered production for documents was issued on December 13th. Those exhibits, which are exhibits 6, 7, and 8, you can find them in the court file, in the exhibits file, under a PDF that's marked 213-11, state that the bank, the defendant's bank, has 30 days to get us those records. 30 days from December 13th would have been January 13th, 2012. We filed our motion to consolidate 12 days after we filed our initial motion, or our complaint information, rather, 3 weeks before trial. We were definitely up against the wall, but we needed all the time that we took simply to investigate this case. And it's our position that we should not lose this case where we complied with Jeffrey, and the defendant did something that in Jeffrey, the Supreme Court clearly stated would result in waiver of his right to object to sequential prosecution. If there are no further questions, I'll save my last minute for rebuttal.
Of course.
Thank you.
Mr. Mueller.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Judge Berger, let me start with your hypothetical because I think it points out the fundamental problem with the district attorney's argument. They have taken the dicta from Jeffrey, which was really talking about prosecutorial knowledge. One of the issues in these compulsory joinder cases has always been, when are we going to measure the prosecutorial knowledge? Court has said, when it's when jeopardy attaches. And And their argument is that they have conflated prosecutorial knowledge with a timely motion, where they've equated the time prosecutorial knowledge is measured, which is jeopardy in case one, when jeopardy attaches in case one, the start of the first trial, with a timely motion to consolidate. There is no Colorado case that says when must a motion to consolidate be filed. There's no case in Colorado that says because there was a timely motion to consolidate and the defense objects, the defendant therefore waives his rights under the compulsory joinder statute. So what we have here is a very unique, distinctive set of facts. And in this case had been going on for 2.5 years, the 09 case. The indictment came down in 09. In September, when the case was continued, the judge made it very, everybody knew that there were going to be additional charges filed. And Judge Iupa made it very clear that there would be no more continuances. Prior to that time, the case had been set for a 16-week trial. When it became, after there were some rulings on some 404B evidence, apparently, the judge said, well, I think we can do this in 12 weeks. Very difficult to schedule a 12-week trial. He set it out more than 6 months. He set it on March 19th for the trial to commence. And he said, there are going to be no more continuances. This gives the district attorney plenty of time to do what they need to do. They didn't at all say, we can't continue to investigate the documents we have. We can't get it done by March 19th. But what they did do then was wait until February. It was 32 days before trial when they filed the new case.
Pardon me for interrupting, Mr. Mueller, because I want to make sure that I understand the right analytical box for this case. And as I understand your argument from your briefs and today, you are basically saying, and I understand you mean no disrespect to the prosecution, but you're basically saying that the prosecution waited too long and that it dilly-dallied and it put us in a my client in a bad position. He wanted his trial and he wanted it when it was set in March. Aren't these all due process arguments? And the reason that I'm concerned about the right analytical box is that we had a trial judge here who, although he may have given hints, clearly said that he was not going to rule on the due process argument that you made below. So help me with the right analytical box for this case in this appeal.
In this appeal, the right analytical box, I go back to what Judge Berger's question was, and I agree with Judge Berger. If the court were to reject Judge Iupa's findings under the compulsory joinder statute, then I think the proper approach would be a remand for the judges to rule on the other issues. I almost think I heard a concession on double jeopardy issues from the district attorney today, saying that we were trying to protect Mr. Marshall's double jeopardy rights by moving to consolidate these cases. So there was a due process, collateral estoppel, double jeopardy, three arguments made. Judge Iupa basically said, I have concerns about double due process, right, but I don't need to get there. But the proper analysis is under the statute and under the rule, because what we, and under the five factors of jeopardy, because in this appeal, as we sit here today, the district attorney has conceded all five jeopardy factors are met. They conceded at the trial court level, four factors were met. They argued that it wasn't the same criminal episode and that the waiver, that the defendant had waived rights by moving, by objecting to the motion to consolidate. So what we have, I think what the court is presented with, is the court must decide the compulsory joinder issue. And what we have is a case in which all five jeopardy factors are met. It's now conceded. The district attorney has gone from arguing that this was a case of permissive joinder at the trial court to admitting that it's a case of mandatory joinder on appeal. So they're changing their position on that issue. And so the precise issue presented is, when you get an untimely motion to continue, and when a defendant is faced with having to give up his right to speedy trial or other rights. Remember, this was a case set for a 3-month trial. The defense was ready to go to trial. It had been prepared for 2.5 years. Being ready, as the judges on this court know, preparing for and getting ready for a 3-month trial comes at enormous emotional and financial cost. And Mr. Marshall had a right to go to trial in March.
And again, Mr. Mueller, if I may, I'm not trying to argue with you, but I guess my concern is about the use of the word untimely for the issue that we have right in front of us. Because the court never came out and said that there was a due process problem here. So if I may, I'd like to push it ahead a little bit to the language from Jeffrey that the district attorney suggests is what should guide our decision here. Could you address that language for us, please?
Well, that was an example of when, I mean, I think it highlights the difficulty of the judge's task, which is when you are writing an opinion, it being expanded beyond what the purpose of that opinion was. There was no continuance at issue there. What I take the language in Jeffrey to mean is that if the failure to consolidate cases is the fault of the defendant, for example, when there is, and nobody was using timely, but when there is a motion to consolidate and the consolidation is prevented by the actions of the defendant, that could be a case in which the defendant waives. What we now have under both the rule and subsequent cases is that we have a requirement that the defendant assert his rights. So the defendant did that in this case. As soon as case number 2 was filed, as soon as the 2012 case was filed, the defendant said, wait a minute, I am asserting my rights under the rule and under the case law. And this all comes too late. There's no requirement in Jeffrey. There's no standard as to what governs, when is the motion to consolidate going to be timely. That's why Jeffrey and all the subsequent cases in compulsory joinder area say we have to analyze every one of these cases on a case-by-case basis. The facts of every case are important. The facts of every case are important to determine the prosecutorial knowledge standard. And so in this case, the district attorney is under the district attorney's position, they could do as Judge Berger hypothesized. They could come in on the day of trial, speedy trial ready to run, and say, guess what, we have our second case. It's a case of mandatory joinder. And you, if you object to it, we get to bring a sequential prosecution.
Well, isn't at that point, isn't your remedy to convince the court that you do have a due process violation, that you've got the prosecution coming in on the day of trial, you've prepared this 3-month thing, and you know at this point your choice is extremely stark. It's accept this thing with all this discovery you've never seen, or continue your case, and on the day of trial, isn't that a due process problem? I mean, and at that point, if the court says yes, it's a due process problem, doesn't that solve it?
I think it could, but I don't think it has to. I think Judge Iupa was perfectly within his, I think Judge Iupa's ruling is right under the compulsory joinder statute. Don't get me wrong, I think there was a clear due process violation in this case. And I think that's a second and subsequent reason why this case must be dismissed. But I think Judge Iupa's ruling under the statute is absolutely right, because the prosecutor cannot sit on the second case and say, gotcha, and now, because it was conceded, there was no way the defense could have properly, does that mean I'm out?
No, you've got 5 minutes.
Okay, thank you. That's right. I thought it was already in the negative area.
Yeah.
There was no way the defense could have obviously been prepared to render effective assistance of counsel when 32 days before a trial, they get a new charge. And in this case, what the prosecutor was trying to do was amend this amend the indictment by filing an information, because the information in the 2012 case alleged as predicate acts for the coke accounts all of the counts in the 2009 case. Now, what was really going on, I don't know. But this dilatory and tactics of the prosecutor and putting the defense in a situation where after 2.5 years, Mr. Marshall would have been forced to say, okay, I have to agree to a continuance and let them consolidate these cases, which should have been done long ago, or and waive my right to speedy trial, or on the other hand, do what he did, which is say, I object.
Mr. Mueller, as I understand your argument, you're saying essentially here the non-joinder didn't result from the defendant's opposition to the motion to join so much as it resulted from the circumstances of the case,
yes,
the judge's prior rulings, and the necessity that in order to have the joinder, you had to give up your speedy trial rights.
Exactly.
Mr. Mueller.
Yes, Judge Berger.
If the charges in case number two had been filed by the end of the year, the prior year, and the motion to consolidate similarly had been filed by the end of that prior year, that seemed to be like a target that people were moving towards. You thought it was a deadline. They thought it was a target, at least. But assuming that had been done, would you lose?
Would I lose if we had objected to a motion to consolidate at that point?
Right.
Not necessarily, because we're getting a lot of hypotheticals here, but assuming all other things are the same, we still have the problem where they are trying to bring amend an indictment substantively, which you cannot do under Rule 6-8 by filing the information in this case, because the information, basically what I think was going on, and this is a little bit of supposition, but remember in the 2009 case, we learned from the hearings that the coke accounts had been dismissed in 2009. And the district attorneys had been unhappy about that, and they considered an appeal, but they could have gotten a superseding indictment. They could have gone back to the grand jury, but they didn't. What they did is, on the eve of trial, file a 2012 information putting in coke accounts and saying all the predicate acts from the 2009 case constitute our predicate acts. All the counts in the 2009 case are predicate acts for the 2012 case. So I think, in a direct answer, it really would have depended. If the information looked the same, I think the objection still would have been there, that you can't do it this way. There were other things the district attorney could have done. They could have dismissed the 2009 case and just gone with the 2012 case. Why didn't they do it? They might have lost a few counts because of the statute of limitations. As Judge Ayuba said, they wanted to have their cake and eat it too, and they couldn't do it the way they did it.
If I may, going back to your Rule 6.8 argument, what about Rule 13 that talks about the consolidation of indictments and informations?
Well, that's an interesting point, because Mr. Baker argues that if it's a case of permissive joinder, it must be in a single indictment, a single information, a single charging document, but that for a mandatory joinder, it doesn't have to be. But I don't see it being that clear in the rule. It talks about being in a single prosecution. But one could read Rule 13, I would argue, to say that when they refer to indictments, information, complaints, and summons, they must be the same charging document. Although we all know under Rule 7, you can amend an information at any time prior to trial, even as to substance. I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mueller. Mr. Baker, you have about a minute.
Neither the defendant nor the trial court recognized it, but we acted as we did in this situation to protect the defendant, in part. We methodically investigated the charges in the 2012 case. We didn't file charges until we determined we had probable cause to believe crimes had been committed. If the district court's ruling in this case is upheld, our concern isn't going to be in the future to do a thorough investigation. Our concern is going to be a rush to judgment, a race. What's going to be soon enough to get charges filed? Will it be 3 months before trial, 2 months? We don't know. We don't have any standards if Jeffrey's not applied. And in that situation, we're simply going to be looking to get something filed so that we can hopefully meet the judge's whim. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. We appreciate them very much. The case will stand submitted. An opinion will issue in due course. Please, safe journey home. And